at 89.3 FM. This is member supported. WPFW, Washington.
Good evening. My name's Garland Nixon, and welcome to WPFW 89.3 FM. The name of the show is News Views, and I'm on here every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. There's a lot of traffic out there. There's a lot of rain happening. Well, there's always a lot of traffic in the D.C. area, but there's a lot of rain. Traffic is moving a little bit slower than normal, so we're going to have a good show here, and something to keep you occupied in your cars while you're driving around, or rather sitting still waiting for the car in front of you to move. Something to keep you mellow so there won't be any, crazy drivers, freaking out and, you know, cutting people off and running into the back of people and all of those kind of unsavory things that tend to happen in traffic. It's going to be nice and mellow today because you're going to be focused on WPFW 89.3 FM here in Washington, D.C. I'm right here with Mark Levine. Mark Levine, are you there?
I am here. I'm stuck in that traffic and, two blocks from the studio right now.
Well, that's just wonderful, Mark. Well, we have a brilliant guest today, who wrote a couple of books. Are you, Tim Melly? Are you there, Tim?
Yes, I am.
Tim. Tim Melly has written we got a couple books to talk about. The first is one of our favorite subjects here on, News Views. It's on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. The name of the book is Empire of Conspiracy Culture of Paranoia. For those of you who listen to the show regularly, you know we had a great show a few weeks back on conspiracy theories, and we had all of our friendly conspiracy theorist listeners call in, and they had a jolly old time telling us about chemtrails and all the other things that are that they believe to be threatening our very existence. And Tim. Oh, and his second book, the second half hour, you're really gonna listen to this. The second book's called The Covert Sphere. Okay, The Covert Sphere. Secrecy, Fiction, and the National Security State. I think you're gonna be ready for that one. So Mark, Tim, 89.3 FM, WPFW, Washington, D.C. Time to talk about conspiracy theories. Tim, tell us about your book, what it's all about. When we hear conspiracy theory, that could mean you're a conspiracy theorist yourself, or you're debunking them all, or what is the kind of the theme of your book, Empire of Conspiracy, Culture of Paranoia?
Okay. Well, I hope I'm neither a conspiracy theorist nor a debunker. Not that I don't disbelieve in some conspiracy theories, but my interest is in really trying to think about why conspiracy theory has become such a popular way of thinking about power.
Mm-hmm.
There have always been conspiracy theories. There's nothing really new about them. But in the last 50 or 60 years, they have really become widespread. So one of the things I'm interested in is why that's the case. Why are so many people, not just people that are on the fringes of society, but even powerful people, using conspiracy theory to think about what's going on in our society? You may remember that Hillary Clinton described some of the things going on against her husband.
The great right-wing?
Right-wing.
Yes. Vast.
Even pretty highly placed people tend to think there are conspiracies afoot. And I think there are a number of reasons for this that are both psychological but also historical. And the historical ones are, I really think that the media landscape has changed in a way that has forced a lot of us to question traditional authority.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just give you an example of that. We used to go to the doctor for medical advice, and now we can go on the internet and we can sort of diagnose ourselves. So that's, in a way, that's really wonderful. That gives us access to more information. It takes the doctor out of the center and allows us to kind of go around the doctor a little bit. The danger is that we make poor interpretations of our symptoms.
You're right.
So there's actually a condition now called cyberchondria, where people get some information, but they lack the clinical authority and experience to make a good diagnosis, so they interpret things poorly. And I think conspiracy theory is rooted in a similar kind of change in structures of authority.
Well, let me just say, Tim, that while I'm not a conspiracy theorist by any stretch of the imagination, I tend to be a believer in Occam's razor, the least complicated answer to a question is most likely the correct one. I was a victim of cyberchondria when it first, basically, I started, I went on the air and, anything to have my foot would hurt or my throat would hurt or whatever the case may be. And what I didn't realize at the time that is that there are some very general symptoms that any disease that you have, dizziness or something or a rash on the skin or something, which we all have some rash at some point in our lives. And I can see that how conspiracy theorists could kind of fall victim to that same type of thinking, because when you start looking for symptoms of a disease, things are so general that whichever disease you focus on, you think you have it. And I can imagine if you have a conspiracy theory that the things that are happening out there are so general that any theory you come up with, you can find some what appears to be credible evidence to support your theory. Mark, are you there?
Yes. For me, part of this strikes me because I do a show called The Inside Scoop. I'm all about real life conspiracies. I think Hillary Clinton was right. Richard Milenstein was out to get Bill Clinton and had a secret Arkansas project.
The Arkansas project, that's right.
To find all his secret dalliances and so forth. And, the 2000 election was stolen. So I'm all about the real conspiracies out there. But then, I see crazy stuff that I think is crazy, like that George Bush blew up the World Trade Center. I don't go there. But what I do is I look at the facts and the conspiracies bear out. So part of it is there are real life secret groups of people working together for a common goal that if you are of a different political bent would seem nefarious. That's true. And then there's some really whacked out stuff, aliens landing and Loch Ness Monster or whatever. So I guess my question for you is, since I believe in some conspiracies and I reject others based on evidence, of course, I think I'm right. Why do other people come to different conclusions?
Well, I think that's a great point, and I'm right there with you. I think there are conspiracies. I mean, if we take the word conspiracy by its original meaning, then every member of Congress is a conspiracy theorist because I think they all believe that there was a group of 19 plotters that blew up the World Trade Center. That was a conspiracy. And it was, a pretty effective one. I think there are a lot of things that have to be explained through conspiracy theory. But when we use that term nowadays, and I mean this in the social sense, when people use that term, they typically use it in a dismissive way. And, a conspiracy theory must be wrong or crazy. And I think typically when people theorize conspiracies, they're no longer thinking so much about small groups of plotters as they are thinking about these giant, vague systems that are controlling all kinds of events in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a fundamental change in the way that the term has been used. To go back to your point, I think that teasing out the differences between theories that are no more than guesses and theories that seem to be rooted in evidence is very important. But if you think about the root, if you think about, let's just take your example of the World Trade Centers. There's a group of people that believes the government blew up the World Trade Centers. If you think about why you believe that that's not the case, is it that you really know, that you have some sort of knowledge, or is it that you trust that certain kinds of authorities are accurate? You might want to, we could think about that in terms of global warming. I don't know a whole lot about global warming, but I believe that when 99% of scientists think it's a problem, I tend to go along with that. But my feeling in that regard is rooted in belief and in a trust of authority and the traditional procedures that ground scientific authority. For a lot of people, there's the idea that there's some reason to trust authorities is fundamentally gone.
Yeah, I think there's, generally the term conspiracy theorist or theory is used in the pejorative now in our society because, and specifically because of, I think, some of the rather outlandish World Trade Center claims and the Bilderberg group and all these other things that we're hearing, you know, and there's green lizard space aliens that are running our world. When we look at the history, if we go back to the United States, this is nothing new. You know, I've read a lot about when the Irish and the Italians first came, and there was a big influx of Catholics, that there were grand conspiracy theories about the Pope and that these Catholics were all conspiring to take over our dear Protestant Christian land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of conspiracy theories are rooted in not only a distrust of authority, but a sense of lost agency or control,
mm-hmm.
A sense that somebody else is controlling things, and also a fear that the world is fundamentally changing in a way that is problematic. So you get the people like Timothy McVeigh, who blew up the Oklahoma federal building, believing that this Zionist world government was sort of taking over and creating a multi-ethnic society. So you do get this sort of pattern in which a lot of conspiracy theorists believe that their way of life is being threatened.
Yeah, in fact, as I understand it, he read a book, a well-known book amongst some of the racist conspiracy theorists called The Turner Diaries, if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, The Turner Diaries is this.
If you can talk about The Turner Diaries a little bit so that our listeners will know about it.
Sure. The Turner Diaries is a very popular book among a certain subculture of white supremacist Americans and sort of patriot groups. It's a fictional account of a kind of apocalyptic scenario in which the government has tried to enforce a sort of multicultural world on people, and a group of white separatists are fighting back. And it's been very influential in encouraging people to fight the government, distrust the government, and so on.
And of course, one of the things that Garland pointed out about Catholics, Timothy McVeigh, Zionist conspiracy is an attack on Jews. People attack blacks or whites or whatever it is. It's easier to blame a specific group of which you're not a member for all the problems of the world. And I guess my question for you is, okay, we have these horrible things happening, globalization, shrinking of the middle class, wages not going up, and they have complex solutions and frankly complex causes. There are, yeah, you can talk about things that Wall Street has done and very specific things and so forth, but I guess it's easier for people to take this complex global economy that's harming them and say, it's the Jews' fault, or it's the Catholics' fault, or it's some subgroup of which they're not a part. I assume that's an easier explanation than going through the complications of the banking industry.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And, I would just point out that not all conspiracy theories blame an ethnic subgroup or a particular group of people. A lot of them blame some sort of incredibly vague them, some sort of either it's a government agency
mm-hmm.
or some constellation of corporate forces and government forces that's run by vague, mysterious people. So oftentimes I think the protagonists, the people that are supposedly controlling the world, are not really even specified in conspiracy theory. The other thing I would just point out is that I think there is a good impulse in a lot of conspiracy thinking or conspiracy theory. I think conspiracy theory is an attempt to think sociologically. It's an attempt to think about what you just described as complex problems. It's usually a very poor attempt to do that, because what it tends to do is to reduce sociological causes to individual intentions. So the conspiracy theorist tends to take a problem that is rooted in institutional inequity or certain kinds of bureaucracies or rules, financial or economic structures, and reduces it to a plot that is being organized out of some back office somewhere.
Once again, you're listening to 89.3 FM WPFW here in Washington, D.C. We're live. Hopefully you're out there in your car nice and safe listening. If not, if you're out in the hinterlands, you can't get us, things aren't too clear, you can go to WPFW.org, and we are live online also. I'm here every Friday with my cohort and partner in crime, Mark Levine, who's lurking in the background even as we speak. And tonight, we have Mr. Timothy Melly, Dr. Timothy Melly. He is the author of Empire of Conspiracy, Culture of Paranoia, and we will be on until 7 o'clock. There is a term in your book that you use.
Thank you.
Agency panic. Can you tell us a little bit about agency? It sounds like Mark has arrived here.
I have arrived. Yes.
Okay. Agency panic. What's it mean?
Agency panic is an intense anxiety that a person has lost self-control. It's sometimes a feeling that that actions in the world are being controlled by somebody else. At times, it even amounts to a sense that one's own thinking is being controlled by somebody else. It's a kind of typical example would be the idea that people are have been brainwashed or controlled to think in a certain way. There are people who become extremely anxious that everything, even history itself, is being organized by some set of intentions or motives.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that that I've noticed about post-World War II U.S. culture is that that's an incredibly common feature of even really good literature. It became a popular idea during the Cold War, and it still continues to be an important feature of our culture.
I was thinking of The Matrix as a good example of agency. Everything we think or feel is actually controlled by someone else.
That's kind of the ultimate conspiracy theorist movie, isn't it?
I guess it is.
That movie is, I think, is actually a brilliant movie.
I love it, too. From the perspective, I'm into philosophy, from the perspective of Baudrillard and the various, you know, Plato's allegory of the cave and things of that nature. I love it. It's absolutely one of my favorite movies, if not my favorite.
That's right. And that movie, what that movie's really trying to do is to help us understand what ideology means in the Marxian sense of ideology, which is to be trapped in a world of ideas and not to be able to see reality. So, you just mentioned Plato, which is an earlier version of a similar idea. But that movie really does a great job of suggesting that the United States is kind of an isolated bubble that is separated from the rest of the world, and those of us who live in it can't really grasp the reality outside it, that it's far more bleak.
And, of course, there's mental illness, too. You know, I think of people on schizophrenia that actually see alternative realities going on all around them at the very time they exist. So I guess I still come back to, you're right, I don't believe the World Trade Center was bombed, but I do believe the 2000 Supreme Court, stole the election. Partly I'm a lawyer, so I can read Bush v. Gore, and I have the training to evaluate, okay, it's not true. But as you point out, I'm not a climate scientist, and yet I believe 99% of scientists. So this appeal to authority, is that the antidote to conspiracy theories? You simply go to the people who supposedly know what they're talking about and trust them.
Well, that's the antidote. The problem is that becomes difficult, and that brings me back to a second major thing that I believe is at the root of the rise of conspiracy theory, and that is the rise of covert government.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Since the 1950s, the U.S. government has increasingly rooted its foreign policy in secret institutions and clandestine activity. And that's a public secret. It's not really a secret. It's widely known. The more that we know about it, the more that people come to realize that our government policy requires public deception and
the infamous psyops.
Yeah, so...
So who do you know who to believe? I mean, at the end of the day, if the government's lying to you, which I think, correct me if I'm wrong, until, say, Nixon, really until the 70s, even in Vietnam, a lot of people simply trusted their government, it turns out wrongly. I assume it was really the 60s and the 70s when people started to finally say, ooh, wait, maybe our government isn't telling us the truth.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what happened was in the 1950s, it's important to remember that after World War II, the U.S. government got rid of its intelligence agency, and it was reborn as the CIA in 1947. And almost immediately, a clandestine group within the administration gave the CIA the power not just to do espionage, but to do covert action. And it put into writing in a really boring-sounding memo called NSC 10-2 that the government needed to be able to plausibly disclaim responsibility for any of the acts that CIA took. And that put the president in the position of publicly misleading the citizens of his own democracy, not just because he was a bad president or a liar, but because it was a requirement of his policy.
Let me ask you a quick question, and this is, you know, fodder for the conspiracy theorists. Am I mistaken? There was a number of books. Operation Paperclip was one of them. I don't know if you're familiar with this. Are you familiar? My understanding is that one of the founders of the CIA was, in fact, a former Nazi military officer.
I don't think that's true, but the CIA used it very much relied on captured Nazi scientists for some of its early programs.
Wernher von Braun, our space program.
Yes.
Yeah, and the MK Ultra program, which is probably the worst, one of the most notorious programs the CIA engaged in, used a number of Nazi scientific practices and discoveries. It was a program that tried to create a mind control weapon. And so it was basically the CIA's attempt to develop a method of brainwashing. They were quite serious about it. They spent millions of dollars using scientists to try to develop this method. And that's now the basis of what we call enhanced interrogation. So it actually still has an afterlife. But there were Nazi scientists involved in that project.
Right, and it's well known that the U.S. did recruit some ex-Nazis. And things after a number of guys with some really nasty records after World War II. And things like that, you know, I think one of the issues is our government has done things that are so, you know, are so underhanded and really go against the principles that most people believe, that it makes it very easy for people to buy into even this, some of the more outlandish conspiracy theories, because we've done some outlandish things.
Could I ask a follow-up? Just something very fascinated me when you said basically the president under this obscure national security, is it law? Is it executive order?
National security, it's actually a memorandum, a National Security Council memorandum, which is, it's kind of a covert law.
So it has the force of law. It's like an executive order.
It's an executive order, but it doesn't have the force of law. It isn't a law because it hasn't gone through Congress.
Right, but executive orders are where the president basically works in the interstices, where Congress says, you know, you can do stuff on this, and the president lays out specifics within the overall approval of Congress. Is that
right?
I mean, there must be some congressional act that overall authorizes this, is there not?
Well, the National Security Act authorized this, but and also the Congress provides funding for it.
Right.
But the Congress was not privy to, or at least most members of Congress still aren't privy to intelligence matters. There's a subcommittee that has
right.
access.
Right. The Select Committees on House Select Committee on Intelligence.
Right.
But here's my question. When you said basically the president is authorized to lie, something that came to my mind is just recently, a few weeks ago, maybe it was a few months ago actually, James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, was asked a question by, I believe it was Ron Wyden of Oregon, or was it Russ Feingold, one of those two. But he was asked basically whether the United States was collecting massive amounts of data on American people. And, of course, we now know they were. Of course, I'm not surprised they were. Edward Snowden.
They were under Bush, so
yeah,
why would
exactly.
they stop?
Edward Snowden didn't tell me anything I didn't already know. But Clapper said no, they weren't. And what's fascinating to me is, number one, he was under penalty of perjury. So you'd think that lie would be under penalty of perjury. But number two, there's this directive that you just mentioned that allows him to lie. So it sounds to me like, which is it? Can you lie to Congress under this directive? How far does it go?
Yeah. So I, first of all, I would say this is not a directive that tells the president to lie. I wouldn't describe it that way. I think the president can lie if he or she wants to. That's up to him or her. But
unless he's under oath.
Right. Right. Exactly.
But theoretically,
what this language says is, and this is a direct quote, is if uncovered, the U.S. government can plausibly disclaim responsibility for the covert actions taken by the CIA.
Right. So if a spy gets caught, we can say of our U-2 pilot, we don't know who he is.
Yeah.
Even though he's flying a U.S. plane. And
well, let's talk about, once again, we're with Tim Melley. He's the author of a book, Empire, Conspiracy, Culture of Paranoia. Let's talk about, I know there are some very interesting chapters. Let's talk about some of the more interesting chapters in your book, Empire of Conspiracy, that you find particularly interesting and you think our listeners would take a liking to.
Okay. I have a chapter that's about addiction, strangely enough, because I think the culture of addiction that has sort of developed in the United States has something to do with conspiracy and with what I call agency panic. Agency panic is, for the listeners that just tuned in, is this sense that you're being controlled or that you can't control your own actions. And it's really at the root of conspiracy theory. It's also, I think it's important to say that it's not just a crazy or pathological approach to the world, but it's actually part of a very wide mainstream set of writings that tried to describe social changes after the 1950s. And I think you see the same kinds of things in the recent discourse on addiction. Which is really paradoxical. So one of the things to just notice about it is that we now describe as addictions all the things that used to typify individual agency, like exercise, shopping.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, shopping is very interesting. You're going into the market and making choices about your desires. But in the contemporary discourse of addiction, it's an uncontrolled action that's being dictated by advertisers or by some sort of internal pathology.
Oh, that's a good point. I like that. I never thought about that. That's a brilliant point. Yes, yes, yes. And, we discuss the issue of consumerism, and you're right. Even I have discussed it from the perspective that, there are these companies out there that have these, these brilliant advertising, psychological
that's a conspiracy, right? Subliminal advertising.
Subliminal advertising.
I remembered as a kid, someone once told me, if you look really closely in those alcohol ads, and I don't know if this is true or not, you see skulls and sort of things because you want to kill yourself, and therefore, and I thought I saw one in an ice cube one day, but I'm not sure any of that's true.
Yeah, well, that's based on a book called Subliminal Seduction from the 60s or 70s, but that book in turn, which was quite popular, is rooted in a more serious book called The Hidden Persuaders by a guy named Vance Packard, who was a cultural critic in the 1950s. And he described, he sort of warned Americans that advertisers were trying to control their thoughts using the insights of modern psychiatry. So they were using something like psychological warfare on consumers.
Mm-hmm. And
what I start the book by doing is comparing Vance Packard to J. Edgar Hoover, who was trying to describe communists as doing exactly the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
On one hand, you've got this anti-communist describing communist thought control. There are all these communists around. They're trying to control and manipulate your thoughts. On the other hand, you have this this cultural critic describing how capitalists are trying to do the exact same thing. And I think that leads to a society in which people are always worried that they're being manipulated. They're always worried that someone is trying to control their behavior, try to get them to do something, and they become very skeptical and suspicious.
And then people start believing that we're kind of walking around like zombies, being told to do things, and we've lost all control. And it gets to the point, earlier in the week I was looking through some websites of people who believe that the government is beaming thoughts into their brains from, there's an entire subculture of people who actually, they exchange information and they have these listservs. and they believe that the government is beaming information into their brains so they have no control. And if they have pain, their back hurts because the government shot some beam to their back.
Do they wear tinfoil hats to prevent the beams from going through?
No, but I do know of an instance.
I'm wearing mine right now.
Okay.
I do know of an instance of a person who wore cardboard on their back with tinfoil wrapped around
it. No way.
Because they believed that the government was beaming some beam to their back to give them back pain.
See, I think most of those people are schizophrenics or psychotic in some way. They actually, but maybe I'm making too extreme a point.
That's the question, Tim. Are they mentally? Is there a kind of a cliff that you go over? Is there an edge, a line that you cross where it becomes mental illness as opposed to, you know, just kind of some more general paranoia,
skepticism,
paranoia? Where do you go?
That's a great question. So, I mean, I think the answer is obviously that some people who believe in those things probably are mentally ill. But it's what's interesting to me, and obviously you need to look at individuals to make that kind of judgment. What's interesting, what you're describing there is what Victor Tausk, a psychologist from the early 20th century, called the influencing machine delusion. He was a disciple of Freud, and he described this delusion that patients sometimes had that they were being controlled by a sort of remote control. If you read Don DeLillo's novel of the Kennedy assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald has this delusion. He thinks that some people in the CIA are trying to control him through messages that come through his TV. But I think what's sort of important about this is not whether people are crazy or not, but that if they are crazy, they are nonetheless describing something that is a far more mainstream idea, which is that there are forces in society that are broadcasting messages that have been designed to influence and control us. I mean, one common form of that is advertisement.
Mm-hmm.
I often point out to my students that they're wearing advertisements all over their bodies, and they look at me sort of surprised, and then they look at their T-shirts and go, oh, you're right, there we are. Why did I do this? Certainly there's nothing schizophrenic or crazy about the idea that media messages are powerful, that mm-hmm. they do try to influence us. And going back to this question of the antidote, I think that the antidote to these forms of attempted control is being a good reader, being trained to be a critical thinker who's capable of looking at messages and understanding the sorts of appeals they make, how they try to motivate us emotionally, how they connect certain kinds of ideas to various kinds of visual imagery to get us to believe things. And once we're critical and we can start to take some of those messages apart, we're less likely to be subject to their claim.
And that makes sense to me. My guess is that more educated people, while they can be susceptible, are less susceptible to conspiracy theories than people who have very little education in critical thinking.
Well, sometimes, and there are other instances where that have been studies have shown that sometimes people who are more educated are more certain. And
they're more certain,
and they're much better at rationalizing it because they have a lot more information to rationalize their otherwise irrational belief. So it all depends on, you know, the educated person you're talking about.
Do we have to take a break?
Okay, sure.
No. Do we on the half hour or no? Okay, we don't.
Okay, we're still rolling.
So let me ask you a question about educated people.
Let me just pick up on that, because I think you're making a very good distinction between skepticism and belief.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's often a tipping point between the healthy skepticism and distrust of authority that begins some conspiracy theories and then the absolute belief in a clear explanation that often becomes the excessive and erroneous part of conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
They start with suspicion. They think, I don't believe the official story, which is not a bad – you know, which is not a bad attitude to have.
I kind of start with that frequently myself.
I'm very suspicious of George Zimmerman right now, but I don't know what happened that night because I wasn't there. So I can say I'm very suspicious of him. I think he did it, but honestly, I have to admit in the back of my rational mind that I really don't know for sure what happened that night. And frankly, the only two people that did, one's on trial and the other one's dead. So I guess you have to at some point distance your suspicion from what you rationally know.
Yeah, from a healthy skepticism to an unhealthy suspicion. to an unhealthy, to paranoia.
I may even be right. I mean, he may have caused, I actually think he probably is guilty, but at the end of the day, how do we mix what we know and what we don't know in ways that make us rational and not crazy?
Well, I mean, I think one definition of being educated is knowing the limits of your knowledge and being
Makes
able
sense.
To admit when you can't know or don't know completely and being open to alternative explanations. Brilliant thinkers that have changed paradigms, intellectual paradigms in previous centuries, are people that don't just assume that what everyone has told them is right. So it's very important to be that rational, critical person. What I find problematic is that people leap, and I see this in my students and sometimes in myself too, people leap to conclusions when they don't really have enough evidence to draw a conclusion.
You know, very brilliant historical figures that come to mind is, first of all, Socrates, who would say, "The only thing I know is that I know nothing." And my favorite Socrates quote is, "I only consider myself wiser than other men because I am conscious of my own ignorance." And then you have Descartes, who said, "You know, every 10 years, everything that I believe, I realize it's wrong, and I start all over, start off from scratch." And I recall, you know, a few weeks back when I had the conspiracy show, and we had our conspiracy theorists calling in,
and we have a lot of them, and they were calling in, and we love you.
But the question that I would ask everyone was this: is there any possibility that you could be wrong? Because in my opinion, there are things that I suspect or believe or think about nature and energy and things of that nature. But I keep in mind that while I believe that, it's possible that I could be wrong. And I think that's, in my opinion, that's where you go from healthy skepticism and thoughtful conspiracy theories to paranoia and irrationality when you say, "I have this convoluted, complicated answer as to how and why things happen, and there's no possibility that I could be wrong."
So let's go on to, because I like controversial subjects, how do you deal with religion? Isn't that a massive belief in something that cannot be proved, whether it be God or, in my tradition, a burning bush, or in the Mormon tradition, golden plates that a guy in 1844 dug up from the ground and then mysteriously disappeared because the angel told him to destroy them and no one else saw the plates? I mean, aren't you in danger when you talk about conspiracy theories of taking 90% of the world's population and calling us crazy?
Well, I would never call religion a conspiracy theory. In fact, I'm cautious about using that term. But I think it's a great question, because what you're really getting at is the line between the knowable and the unknowable.
Mm-hmm.
And the rational procedure is wonderful when applied to the knowable. But when we talk about the core of religious belief, we're talking about something that's fundamentally rooted in belief and not and can't be known or proven in a kind of modern scientific paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing to maybe just say about religion is that a lot of conspiracy theorists have a religious, or not, sorry, not conspiracy theorists, but conspiracy theories have a quasi-religious quality to them.
Yes, they do.
They attribute agency and control to a kind of divine substitute, to something that seems a lot like God. It's just up there. It's invisible. It's doing all kinds of powerful things to control the outcome of the world. And it has a kind of magical quality that is supremely knowledgeable and competent and efficient. And it's localized in a single consciousness.
And the other thing that, now, you know, I never thought about it. That's a brilliant point you just made. But from the perspective of religion, this you know, is this entity that they believe in is generally an evil entity. So conspiracy, you know, it's the government and all these groups are doing these bad things. They're never doing anything to help us. They have a devil in their abstract religion.
That's
they have a devil,
need,
but
we,
no God.
We need God, because that's our conspiracy theory that actually people, some force is trying to help us. It's counterweight, actually.
That's exactly right. And it might be worth remembering that Freud's original description of paranoia, where he defined the syndrome, is based on the case of a German judge named Schreber. And Schreber wrote a very famous memoir called Memoirs of My Nervous Illness, in which he believed he was being tormented by God. So he believed he was in a special relationship with God, and God had sent out these rays, and fibers that were kind of cutting through his body and torturing him, and that God wanted to marry him, that he wanted Schreiber to be his bride. So the idea of religion and paranoia, they're sort of connected right from the beginning of that disorder as a definable syndrome.
Until you got to the marriage, I was following along with the Book of Job. I mean, it's pretty much follows. It's all directly from there until, of course, you get to the marriage part.
Well, there's another perspective that I see often in conspiracy theorists, and that is some kind of a weird narcissistic, almost kind of messiah syndrome kind of thing, where a person who otherwise feels unimportant and meaningless, suddenly the government has chosen me,
or God has
followed,
chosen,
or whoever it is. It may be they say the government's following me, the government's tapping my foot, the government's doing all these things, and all these entities are after me, or God, or whoever it is, where they elevate themselves to this importance that the government has chosen them out of 300 million people to aim all their satellites, to focus all their men in the black sedans with black suits and, the black glasses look. All these things are focused. Billions of dollars are being focused on them, or, God, or whoever.
That's exactly the point that Freud makes in that case, is that paranoia is rooted in fundamentally in narcissism, in a sense of grandiosity, that you are more important than other people, and therefore you've become the subject of this malign agency because you are so important and so, essential.
Yeah, in fact, I know of an instance of a person who has kind of a messiah syndrome thing going on. I mean, the person hopefully is fairly harmless, but the person's mentally ill, and they have, God has chosen me to do whatever it is that God has chosen them to do.
Let me suggest one thing. I'd be curious, sort of, in the human brain. My guess is that certainty. I don't know, and I'd have to have a physiologist and let me know whether this is true or not, but my guess is that certainty gives us a certain endorphins. We have solved the puzzle. We have figured out the riddle. I know if I'm trying to solve a difficult puzzle and I figure out the riddle, I'm happy. I got it. I got the answer on the test. And so since life is so complicated and since misery happens and is tragic and, frankly, has no real reason behind it, that's actually why we have the Book of Job. It's a chance to try to explain the ultimate horrible religious question, why do bad things happen to good people? And so you have this horrible question that no one can answer in any religion. Everyone tries. And then you have certainty. Aha! I can explain everything, and it gives you those endorphins. And frankly, the more educated, uncertain gray answer is less satisfying than the black and white clear solution. Is that fair?
I completely agree with that. I think, I don't know about the biochemistry, but I think people are very anxious and have a difficult time tolerating uncertainty. I think what a conspiracy theory particularly gives people is a causal explanation.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of an explanation that sociological explanations are very unsatisfying. Well, because there's some structural inequality between this group and these laws are a certain way and this historical phenomena happened, blah, blah, blah.
People have already fallen asleep.
That's a sociological explanation. But the conspiracy theorist is able to pin the cause right on a clear agent. And there's, even though that's often scary, it's comforting.
Makes sense. I was just thinking of the Nazis. Every single problem that ever happened to Germany, was caused by the Jews. And it's just easy your train's late, it's the Jews' fault. Whatever it is.
And now we have people that will, that it's the Mexicans.
That's right. In fact, that's exactly who they're blaming today.
Yeah.
Or Arabs, frankly, or the Muslims.
Right.
That's why they want to call our president a Muslim. They don't like our president because he's black, so it's the blacks. And then Muslims are bad, too. And hey, the socialists are bad. And then
foreigners are bad.
So we're going to call Barack Obama a Kenyan Muslim socialist.
Foreigner.
Right. He's got all bases covered. He's a liberal too,
right? And that's it. And that I think that's another part that we another factor we see in some conspiracy theories, and that is a way to deal with people or groups or entities that you already don't like,
right? And so how do you deal? I'm thinking of the birther conspiracy. All right, so. How do people some of these conspiracy theories, they're very, very hard to prove or disprove. Climate science, we can prove, but it takes scientific expertise. God knows we can't prove. We can't prove or disprove God. But when it comes to the birther controversy, when it comes to where Barack Obama was born, and we've got an announcement, we've got a birth certificate, and it's the state of Hawaii, and you've got clear facts, on paper, certified and everything, How do you explain the people that just won't face the fact right in front of their face?
Before you speak, if I may, let's remember what Voltaire said. Any belief that is not founded in reason will not be swayed by it. And I think that's the issue.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in order to believe that, I think it's healthy to take the other side and think through how they might be thinking about this.
Okay. Yeah. How does a birther think about it?
So let's just say you present this birth certificate. Mm-hmm. Well, documents can be forged. I mean, would it be the first time that documents have been forged? So I think yes, there's a birth certificate.
What's the motivation for the? See, that's the thing I don't even understand about the birther controversy. So Barack Obama was really born in Kenya, but we want to sneak him into office as if there aren't, you know, many other liberal black people.
And let's not forget the part of it that makes the least sense. Back in 1961, his parents knew that one day he was going to be president.
Right,
I don't think anybody suspected there was going to be a black president.
So they put a birth announcement in Hawaii, even though he was born in Kenya.
But the other, you know, I watched I think the 10th anniversary or something of 9/11. There was a show on, I think it was the Science Channel, National Geographic Channel, about the 9/11 conspiracies. And what they did specifically, they had the leading, you know, believers, the proponents of the 9/11 conspiracies on. And they went scientifically through what could or couldn't have. They brought in physicists. They, you know, used the type of explosive material that they alleged, you know, with the buildings were built. They did scientific tests. They did everything. And they were able to prove point by point that the 9/11 conspiracy that these people argued was absurd. But every point that they proved, it was kind of like whack-a-mole. You know, they just push this point down and say, hey, this one's absurd. Oh, well, I got an idea. They must have did this instead.
Yeah, one thing that underlies conspiracy theory is this notion that if everything doesn't line up perfectly, there must be some other explanation. So if you notice the guy on the rooftop outside the Boston bombing, that's proof, or that might be proof, that there was a third person involved in the bombing. If you know, with the 9/11 thing, one of the really amazing things that some of the conspiracy theorists did was they took demolition footage from planned demolitions and put it next to the collapse of, I think it was World
Trade Center. They said it looked similar.
And said, look, these floors are falling in the same pattern. Now, if you think about that for a second, how many experts in the world, how many demolitions experts could comment authoritatively on that problem? I mean, how many of them have – well, really, because how many of them have done studies of airplanes?
You're right.
Oh, no, not that. But the planned demolition, but you're right, not the unknown.
Not the
actuality.
Not why the two are similar or dissimilar.
Right.
So one of the things that happens in some of these theories is, first of all, they take the form of a rational scientific presentation. They are, you know, from a certain perspective, they look just like a mainstream news report or a scientific presentation. They have evidence. They make claims. It's not just wild assertions. They present, quote unquote, evidence. And the second thing to notice is that a lot of the underlying sort of hinges of these arguments are very difficult for rational people to disprove. So, you know, when I heard those conspiracy theories, and I get called to do shows like this frequently, there weren't a lot of debunking narratives available. And so, you know, initially, all you could really say is, it just seems crazy. Why would the government do this? But it's very hard to disprove these things by reverting to anything beyond a fundamental sense of trust or a counter skepticism.
Well, the other part of
it
is,
I know, by
this,
the way, just Popular Mechanics finally in like 2004, 2005 gave a point by point refutation of each of
them. Yeah. And the other part is that the conspiracy theorists take the offensive, because the reality of a true argument is, if you make an outlandish claim or if you make some kind of a claim, the burden is on you to prove this claim. I can say, well, Mark here is an alien.
Right.
Mark doesn't have to prove that he's
I'm not an alien.
Yeah, because when he says
maybe I have an Android. You have to cut me open to see if I have electric parts inside.
Because when Mark says I'm not an alien, I'd say, aha, that's exactly what an alien would say.
It is what an alien would say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in some ways, I think a lot of this stuff goes back to the mother of all U.S. conspiracy theories, modern ones at least, which is the Kennedy assassination.
Yes.
Yeah.
So think about that for a second. The government produces a report. The report is 26 volumes long, which just in and of itself, it bespeaks an inability to even decide what counts as evidence in this case.
Right.
There's so much evidence that it's as big as the Encyclopedia Britannica. So what that says to people is that even this government commission couldn't decide, which was made up of Supreme Court justices and lawyers and politicians, couldn't decide what counted as evidence in this very important national case. The full resources of the U.S. government were deployed to solve this mystery, and they did. They came up with an answer, but they also produced something that was so overwhelming that it suggests that even these experts didn't know how to stop looking for additional information. And then the government in 1976 ran the same investigation and found that there probably was a conspiracy. That was the House or the Senate commission that reopened.
Between whom? Lee Harvey Oswald
They didn't say. They just said the chances are that there was a chance that it was likely a conspiracy.
Well, we just don't know. We have to accept the fact that we just don't know.
And
that's the answer that nobody wants to say.
Most people don't even know that there was another person charged in New Orleans related to the Kennedy assassination and ultimately that it was let go.
So, Tim, let me give you what I think is the best antidote to conspiracy theories that I've actually tried and has worked on some conspiracy theorists. And also it happens to be true. So it's one of my favorites.
Worked, then they were very weak in the conspiracy theories.
They
would be considered soft in the conspiracy theory world.
Fair enough. Some did not accept it, but it happens to be something I firmly believe in. So I came to Washington because of Bush v. Gore. I moved from California. I came to save my country because I saw the actuality that the Supreme Court stole the election of 2000. So I started here with a conspiracy theory that I think I can prove. All right. But then when people came to me in the World Trade Center and all these things, here's what I told them. I said, look, I can prove my conspiracy. You can't prove yours. Of course, they think they can prove theirs. But I asked them why they believed it. And instead of telling me, well, the laws with thermodynamics, they'd say, well, Bush and Cheney are very bad people, and so I believe they would do this awful thing. And I said, look, there are things that Bush and Cheney have done that we can prove. They torture people. They waterboard, right? They've admitted that. We can prove the Supreme Court stole the election of 2000. When you mix things that are provable with things that are unprovable, then you weaken the arguments of people like me who also dislike Bush and Cheney but want to make provable arguments there. So you may believe all you want that they bombed the World Trade Center, but if you'll join with me in arguing that they shouldn't torture people or they shouldn't have secret prisons, which was also proven, and you know where they torture people, or they shouldn't spy on all of us, which we knew at that time, or Bush v. Gore, you actually weaken the argument. If your goal is to say this is a bad president, don't weaken the things we can prove with the things that are unprovable because it harms the argument. And that made some of them go away.
But a good conspiracy theorist would say, oh, so they got to you.
I was on air all the time complaining about Bush and Cheney, so maybe I'm a secret agent. But why would I complain about that?
Well, what I always say about conspiracy theorists and everything else is this. There's only one thing I know for sure in life, in the world. And that is, just because I believe something doesn't mean that it's true. And even that creates a paradox, because that means that what I just said, I don't even know if it's true.
You know, I think it's important to keep what you're really talking about there, Mark, is just what it means to know. And I think it's really important for us to think about what we mean when we say that we know something. I think for a lot of people, there's a sense that knowledge can be absolute. Like there's some sort of divine stamp of approval on certain truths or certain statements or propositions and not on others. But we only know anything because a reasonable group of people agree more or less on a set of procedures and definitions, and most people, most reasonable, sane people tend to agree that those procedures have been followed.
Okay, but
that there's some set of knowledge defining activities that have been done. And that's how we know anything.
But, Tim, isn't there some objective truth out there? I got to turn to mathematics. The only objective truth that I think really I can absolutely prove exists, tautology, A equals A, 2 plus 2 equals 4. Can we objectively know at least that to be true?
Well,
By definition, I guess.
I think every I'm a bit more of an idealist than you, I think, in the philosophical sense, because I think all kinds of statements like that already happen within a framework. But I do think the point you're making is a really important one. I believe we can know some things very, very, you know, we can, it's very hard to know anything, quote unquote, for sure, which means that there's absolutely no chance of it being wrong. I mean, it turns out that the sun does not revolve around the Earth, even though everybody knew that that was the case a long time ago.
It was for 1,500 years, from Copernicus to Galileo. Everyone, any brilliant mind, every university in the world, everybody knew that the entire universe rotated around the Earth.
And that was the state of knowledge then, and it worked pretty well. So that's where I'm coming from, but I don't think that we should throw up our hands and say we can't know anything. I think that's dangerous, and what we really need to go back to is really educating people to understand that how we know things is that we interpret certain kinds of facts or events through frameworks that we develop and agree upon and decide are reasonable.
Well, I like that. Go ahead.
No, and until we in this new media environment, until we start to develop new forms of authority and filtering and checking, we're going to live amidst this proliferation of half truths and crazy ideas. But eventually, I'm hopeful that we will come up with those procedures.
By the way, if you want a shout out to half truths, every now and then, go and try to edit Wikipedia. That is a task that it can easily lead to suicide. I have tried several times on political issues to correct a fact and stick in a reliable source, and they're like, no, it's not reliable because it doesn't support my political agenda.
Right.
And make that be wary of you, because we all use sometimes Wikipedia just to look something up real quick, that hidden underneath is all kinds of political agenda.
Well, Mark, if you don't like Wikipedia, you should go to Conservapedia.
Yeah, that's even worse.
It's what is that, Phyllis Schlafly's son or something like that, where they basically have all the evidence to prove a conservative view on the world.
I remember there's an argument on Second Amendment to the Constitution where people didn't want to concede the fact that for 70 years before the new Supreme Court ruling, they held that the militia clause mattered. Now, that's just a fact of law. It was in the New York Times, the Library of Congress, and this guy was arguing valiantly that it should be included, and they're like, nope, we don't like it. And that's, of course, against Wikipedia policies. But, you know, if they're more persistent, sometimes falsehoods become truth simply because those telling the lies are more persistent than those telling
the truth. And that takes us back to The Matrix. One of the books that inspired The Matrix, Baudrillard, was called, I think it's Simulacrum, where he talks about things that simulate reality and things that simulate a reality that never existed in the first place.
Right.
Which is very interesting stuff if you're into philosophy. Although Baudrillard kind of he goes out of the, you know, post-apocalyptic reality stuff really freaks me out.
At the end of the day, it just makes us even more scared because it is uncertain, and that's the problem. And that's
once again, you're listening to 89.3 FM WPFW here in Washington D.C. We have been talking with Tim Melly. He is the author of Empire of Conspiracy: Culture of Paranoia. That is a great book. If you are a conspiracy theorist, if your friends, family members, neighbors are conspiracy theorists, you might want to get this book. No, you do want to get it. Empire of Conspiracy, Culture of Paranoia, Tim Melly, M-E-L-L-E-Y. And it's available at Amazon and all that kind of stuff, right, Tim?
That's right.
Thank you so much for joining us, Tim. We really appreciate you coming here on News Views.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. And coming up next, we've got Carol Tyson and Robin Holden, Robin's Place. They've got great music. There's no conspiracy going. They have a conspiracy to play great music.
There you go.
And
it's not a secret, though.
No,
conspiracy
it's not
a secret.
No, it's not a theory. Yeah. And I suspect, I have a suspicion that they're going to have a great show tonight. What do you think, Mark?
I suspect the same.
And if someone wants to get in touch with you, Mark, tell me, how would they do? Would they just go down to the prison and knock on the door and ask for prisoner 14709?
You can follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk, MarkLevineTalk. My website's MarkLevineTalk.com. You can see me on Monday on Russian TV. And I'm also on Huffington Post Live at 11 a.m. Monday. So there's all kinds of things. Go to my website and you can check it out. And I'll be talking about the national security state and Homeland Security on Monday.
I suspect next week we'll be talking about the Zimmerman
verdict. Probably all week long.
I suspect that's what the show will be about next week. Garland Nixon here. If you want to get in touch with me, at Garland Nixon on Twitter. Or you can Facebook me, of course, Garland Nixon, or email garlandin@gmail.com. Mark and I are going to step out of here. See you next week, 89.3 FM WPFW here in Washington, D.C. Next, coming up, Robin Holden, Carol Tyson at Robin's Place.